This is Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Welcome back in, everybody. It is Wyman and Bob here on 710 ESPN Seattle. A new book out there, which I'm guessing will appeal to a lot of people as it covers the New England Patriots. It's called It's Better to Be Feared, and it's got some good stuff in here. And we've got the honor of talking to the author of this book with us now. Seth Wickersham is here. Seth, how are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm curious. You know, you covered the Patriots for a long time. What, about 20 years, right?
Yeah, well, so I've worked at ESPN Magazine and ESPN.com for 20 years, and so obviously the dominant story of the past 20 years was the Patriots, and so I found myself en route to Foxborough and in Foxborough quite a bit.
Well, and in that time, obviously, you know, being in this business, we hear a lot of things that are behind the scenes, a lot of which never become public and things like that, and I'm just curious from your time covering the NFL, being around this team, and then deciding, hey, I'm going to write this book. How much of what you learned was new, like, wow, I had never heard that, never suspected this, never thought that would happen, or he would say this, that, or the other? Were there many surprises as you dug deep into this?
Absolutely, and there was many moments like that. And I think that, you know, so I started at ESPN in 2000, and one of my very first assignments, actually, was my boss had sent me to Foxborough in November of 2001 to write about, you know, this backup quarterback who was filling in admirably for Drew Bledsoe when he was hurt, named Tom Brady. And I remember he was wearing like a gray sweatsuit and his backpack was full of beer because he had lost a bet between Michigan and Michigan State teammates. And he had payout for his teammates. But I remember at that meeting, he said, you know, football's always come really easy to me. And he didn't say it boastfully. He said it very earnestly. That was one of those moments that becomes lore only in retrospect when you see what happened and you see what everything became. And I felt like that with the book, I not only had a ton of new, fresh reporting that that would add to the narrative, but I also felt like that between that moment and late night conversations with Belichick and being at Brady's house and his Super Bowl party, I felt like I had like a lot of reporting that really hadn't been out there, and I felt like being there for those critical moments was useful when you're trying to tell the story of a 20-year dynasty.
Now, I'll let our listeners know the book came out on Tuesday, October 12th, so it's available wherever books are sold and you can check it out. But I'm curious just what the initial, before we get into details of the stories you've got in there, what's the reaction been? I'm guessing maybe from hardcore Patriot fans there's some level of blowback, or maybe has anybody reached out to you? What kind of response have you received to this point?
You know, it's by and large been positive. And one of the things that I've learned, a lot of the reporting I do at ESPN is investigative reporting. And you spend so much time crafting these things. As a matter of fact, I did a story years ago out in Seattle that was kind of about the Patriots, but it was about Richard Sherman and Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson and that dynamic, and especially after the Malcolm Butler interception and, you know, asking the questions of whether, like, you know, some losses are just too big to recover from. And I remember out in Seattle, I got a lot of pushback and denials. And then that story ended up becoming true and then some over time. And so I feel like that's what happens. Like sometimes you get an initial pushback or skepticism, but, you know, these things end up panning out because of the work that we put into them. And so, but all that said, because that's happened to me a couple times with the Patriots where they pushed back and what I wrote ended up panning out, I think that the feedback has been great because I think people realize that, you know, I work hard and I'm trying to tell an honest and an accurate story.
Seth, tell us a little bit about, I read Education of a Coach, and I ended up just really respecting Bill Belichick, whereas before, you know, he'd always come off as kind of this grumpy guy and a lot of people don't like him. I've always kind of admired him since I read that book, but then, you know, you hear from other people their opinion of him and what kind of a coach he is. What have been your experiences with him?
By and large, I've enjoyed my experiences with him. I've had up and downs with him over the years, but, you know, a lot of the stories that I did over the years were deep dives into things that he was involved in, and he when he would cooperate, he was terrific. You know, he'd always call late at night, maybe when his workday was done. And he was always kind of relaxed and expansive, and his energy level was amazing. And, you know, I enjoyed that book too, but I feel like that, you know, that book came out in 2006, and so much has happened since then. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that, you know, there's a lot more there with Bill Belichick to explore in terms of like how he became so great at this game where greatness is, you know, inherently fleeting. And then what the cost of that greatness were.
What do you think? Do you think the perception of him is fair? I mean, we've gone through, you know, Spygate, Deflategate. He's, you know, he's involved in these things that are, you know, in the football world untoward. So I'm curious if you feel, having been around him and now again doing a deep dive to write this book, you feel the perception of him and the Patriots for that matter is fair.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, one of the things when you write about the Patriots, you see that there's a lot of different perceptions out there about how they do things. And I think that, you know, again, what I was trying to do was look at what are the critical ingredients in Belichick's DNA that allowed him to be great. And I'll give you an example. One of them is that I feel like that, you know, for someone who's so introverted and someone who, you know, can be socially awkward, nobody, no NFL coach has understood the psychology of his opponent like he has. And he has made plays and done moves in games designed to get inside the head of his opponent, knowing that if he was able to like get them to react under stress, they would revert to their most essential selves. And at that point, they would be very predictable. I'll give you an example from that. You know, early part of the century, Patriots are having wild success against Peyton Manning's Indianapolis Colts. And one of the reasons is because they gave Peyton Manning the run up the middle. They would let him run the ball and call runs up the middle all day long, knowing that someone so intellectual and gifted would get bored calling that play. And then when he deviated from it, they'd have him trapped. Obviously, you know, what he did in the final moments of the Super Bowl, sorry, Seattle fans, against Pete Carroll, where he watched and stared out the sideline and really was kind of a master at not panicking and instead letting that situation play out. And then John Harbaugh, you know, when Belichick famously unveiled those Baltimore and Raven formations in the playoff game, one of the reasons why he did it was because he knew that John Harbaugh would get upset about it. He had a very quick fuse. And sure enough, in that game, Harbaugh got a 15-yard unsportsmanlike conduct penalty. It's stuff like that that I think is really interesting, how he gets inside their minds and ends up kind of haunting these coaches.
Yeah, and not calling the timeout when there was the Jermaine Kearse catch there. I mean, I almost thought, well, he did that on accident. But, yeah, I mean, and you read all these things about him and how he'll find one little thing. And I remember the thing was with when they played St. Louis, the Rams, when they were so good, and it was like hit Marshall mm-hmm. Faulk on every play, mm-hmm. hit him. And so, yeah, he just seems to be like a savant. Like he's able to look at film and just able to figure out what another team's weakness is.
Well, they do a lot of scouting reports, not just on teams, but on coaches. What coaches like to call, what coaches, you know, do in certain situations so that he's prepared for that. One of the most interesting things about Belichick is that, you know, you never see him on the sideline carrying a play sheet. And he, as a matter of fact, when he's in big games like that Seahawks Super Bowl, like when they were playing the Rams and Sean McVay a couple years later, he looks at like the opposing head coach as his opponent. And he often wants to find that guy and watch him. He's not staring down at a play sheet calling plays. He's managing the game. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about him is how he sees, you know, football in a very global sense. Now, look, there are fights that involve Bill Belichick in the book. There are cuss words. There are arguments. But by and large, what I'm trying to show here is a real and honest way about, you know, what it's like to work for him, to be around him, the ways that his football kind of genius manifests itself in ways that enrich the lives of a lot of the people around him and often, you know, drive them crazy because he's such a perfectionist and he can be so sour at times.
Seth, how would you characterize his relationship with his players? I know each individual is unique and it's not going to be the same across the board, but I always felt from the outside, for the most part, anybody that did play there or, you know, used to play there, pretty much had his back and really, you know, talked about what it was like and enjoyed playing for him. You know, there are a couple of exceptions, but what did you find in just sort of, you know, how players perceive him?
Well, he's not for everybody, and not every relationship has ended well. And in fact, one of the themes I write about in the book is just, you know, a lot of his relationships, you know, have been rocky at times. Obviously, Eric Mangini, who he was so close with for all those years, Bill Parcells, they didn't talk for a period of time. Obviously, even Tom Brady, to a certain extent, and the way that things ended there. And so I think that there's a cost to his greatness in the sense that he's so resolute and so focused and can be so ruthless and emotionless when it comes to decision making. All that said, and this is something I think that he and Brady have in common. We spend a lot of time talking about their differences, but nobody like these two guys in football history have been optimists like they are. I mean, they believe in the power and the promise of the next play and are able to flush whatever bad happened and focus on what's in front of them like nobody else. And you see that play out on global stages where Tom Brady, down in two Super Bowls by double digits in the fourth quarter, is able to rally his team to win. All of the great goal line stands that Belichick's defenses have engineered over the years, not just Seattle, but go back to 1986 when he was with the Giants as the defensive coordinator, and the Denver Broncos in the Super Bowl had a first and goal and came away with no points. I mean, these guys come at it from different angles. Brady is more earnest and sort of evangelical about his optimism than Belichick is. Belichick's a little bit more of a pessimist who can only see, you know, something positive after he figures out all the ways they can lose a game. But at the end of the day, it's a very rare quality, I think, and it's something that I think has helped make them so successful.
With Belichick, as far as the way he deals with the media, that, like I said, Seth, I've always respected him because he's a football guy. But I mean, I've always said that the way he deals with the media, it's immature, just because it's part of his job. That's what you, when you're an NFL head coach, you have to talk to the media. And just the way that he does that, I mean, it just kind of sits there and grumbles and makes noise and things like that. And it's got to be frustrating to deal with him. And it looks like he's just not ever going to change.
Well, there's a lot of things that go into that, but yes, nobody can tolerate awkward silences like that dude. I mean, after a game, I mean, his press conferences, the misery is so profound that it takes on this kind of like atmospheric quality. And like the loudest noise in the room is often him breathing out of his nose into the microphone.
Oh,
but, you know, he's interesting because he can be different around the media at times. If the larger purpose suits his needs. But I think that he uses those press conferences to reinforce messages to his team. And he's one of those guys, you know, I find it interesting. Like last year, remember at the beginning of the season, I think it was the first game, Tom Brady's playing for the Bucs. He throws like a pick six, right? I think he threw two interceptions and they lost the opener. And Bruce Arians comes out after the game and criticizes Tom Brady. And it looked like Bruce Arians was trying to be like Belichick, right?
Yeah.
Like saying like nobody is above criticism, even though Belichick does it behind closed doors. He never does it from the microphone. And then a day later, what does Bruce Arians do? He comes out and he says, well, not all the interceptions were on Tom Brady. It turns out this one guy ran the wrong route. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why Belichick is so conservative behind the microphone, because he knows that if he were to go out without studying the film from a game, you know, moments after the game ended and try to diagnose all of the problems, that he might be wrong. And I think it's one of those interesting things where it's like, yes, it's boring, and yes, it really drives us crazy in the media, but I think there is a larger purpose there that fits into his overall program.
Seth Wickersham is our guest here on 710 ESPN Seattle with Wyman and Bob. His new book, It's Better to Be Feared, released Tuesday of this week, so it is available wherever books are sold, chronicling the history of this Patriots organization under Bill Belichick and Tom Brady. And one of the excerpts from the book, Seth, that made its way out there pretty quickly before it was released were the comments from the owner, Robert Kraft, on Belichick, saying he's one of the bigger pains in the butt. I'll clean it up. But, you know, not a flattering comment about the guy. Is that a relationship that deteriorated over time? Is that sort of, they've been adversarial, yet he understands, hey, this guy's a great football mind, so I'll just live with it? How did their relationship sort of erode, if it did at all? Maybe it's always been that way. I don't, you tell us.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the beginning of the relationship at the tenure, I think that, you know, Belichick would, you know, kiss Kraft's butt a little bit more. And then as they became more successful, he just kind of stopped doing that. There was one owner's meeting where an executive asked Robert Kraft, you know, what's it going to take for you to fire that a-hole? And Kraft replied, 8-8. But, I mean, that said, it's like, you know, Robert Kraft's an interesting figure in this because he figured out a way to keep this thing together as long as it was. I mean, you guys know how hard it is to keep the window open in the NFL. And he not only pulled off what's probably the greatest trade in NFL history when he traded for Bill Belichick, but he was able to manage Belichick and Brady, two very strong personalities, stubborn in their own way. And yeah, you know, it was exhausting at times. And at one point, yes, he did say that. He was like, I got to go to Detroit to be with the biggest effing a-hole in my life, my head coach. But the bottom line is that he's generally done a pretty good job of keeping this band together as long as it was. And I think that he deserves some credit for that.
Hey, Seth, tell us about, is there something to the fact that Bill Belichick's coaching tree? I mean, you got Matt Patricia, didn't work out so well. Bill O'Brien, I guess Josh McDaniels. Brian Flores looks like he's working out well in Miami, but is there something to that? Is there something about the way he coaches?
Yeah, it's psychological. Like, I actually write an entire chapter about that because, you know, at the middle of the dynasty, all of those coaches, Mangini, McDaniels, you know, even Pioli in Kansas City, were getting plucked and running teams. And Belichick, there was always this inherent irony in the sense that Belichick would hire these guys really young and give them, throw everything at them, give this amazing football education. And yet, when they were on their own, they not only struggled to think for themselves, but they often struggled to actually be themselves. And it was like Belichick, this, you know, like we said earlier, this introvert had become such a dominant cultural presence and presence in their lives that they almost didn't know how to run a program without unintentionally or even sometimes maybe intentionally mimicking him. And I thought that that was like one of the most interesting things. And so I actually spend a lot of time in the book, especially with Eric Mangini when he was with the Browns at that time. I spent a ton of time with him trying to understand why it was so hard for him and others to coach within their own personality and separate themselves from this incredibly powerful and influential figure.
You know, Seth, in light of Tom Brady moving on to Tampa Bay, the conversation became, well, who made who? Who was really responsible for their success? We'll see how Brady does without Belichick. We'll see how Belichick does without Brady. And, you know, if you look at year one, obviously it went Brady's way in a very big way. And to some, that validated their opinion that Brady was the cause or the reason for their success. I mean, obviously, I think it's a 50-50 two-headed monster, if you will. How do you view that now that they're separated and looking at who they are in their respective places? Do you feel like somebody got more credit than they deserved or didn't get as much credit as they deserved for the success in New England?
Well, I think that they were two men who came into each other's lives at the perfect moment because they both understood how fragile success in their profession was. I mean, you had Belichick, whose life was annihilated when the Browns moved to Baltimore, and you had Brady, who almost didn't get drafted. And so they sort of had that philosophically in common, and they knew that they needed each other. And I think that Belichick is always, he knows that it's a quarterback's game. And I think that the hardest thing in professional sports is to identify a Super Bowl caliber quarterback. And with Brady and Belichick, obviously Belichick won the lottery with Tom Brady and he developed the hell out of him. And then he ended up drafting a Super Bowl caliber replacement and developing one in Jimmy Garoppolo before he had to ship him to San Francisco. And then when he picks Mac Jones, I kind of looked at it like a little bit differently than just, you know, filling a need on draft day. I think that when Belichick walks away, whenever that is, he wants the team set up well. He wants to hand a good roster over to his successor, and the quarterback is the pivotal position in that. And so I think that when you look at Mac Jones and them developing him, I think that it's a little bit more, it's not just about the here and now and winning games. I think that it's about, you know, setting up and finding a franchise quarterback that he could lead to his successor one day, whenever that is.
Seth, I get in trouble here in Seattle for talking too much about Tom Brady, but just as an ex-NFL player, I just so admire him. And what I always think about is the picture of him at the combine in his shorts, yeah, with looking like a wet puppy dog, a fifth rounder. And, you know, the guy just is, I mean, he's made himself into the best football player in maybe in league history. Is there any dark side to him? I mean, you saw him, you know, kind of candidly get hammered after the last Super Bowl, and he put that out there. He didn't care. I mean, does he have a dark side?
Well, he's got a temper, and, you know, he's worked to control that. But when he was younger, he was a whiner, and he would kind of just blame everything and everybody except for him. And, you know, his high school coach once told him, like, you are one of a kind. You got to be more patient with people. You're going to be playing in 10 years, which is funny because we think about Tom Brady as nobody ever spotting his talent. Well, a lot of people did, actually. But there was a pivotal night for him at Michigan. He was buried on the depth chart. He's talking to his dad, and, you know, he's like, I don't know if I'm ever going to see the field. And his dad's like, yeah, you might be right. So he goes to Lloyd Carr's office, the head coach at Michigan, and he says, you know, you think he's going to transfer to Cal. And that night he goes and visits with his counselor, a man named Greg Hardin. And he's whining to Greg Hardin about where he is and how he can't get up at the depth chart. And Greg Hardin, his counselor, starts laughing at him. And he basically says, you want to leave, go ahead. You haven't done bleep here anyway, and no one's going to care if you go. Like, go for it. Walk out that door. And it was really a key moment, because if Brady had walked out the door and gone to Cal, he probably would have had a good career and probably would be in business right now. Mm-hmm. But instead, that lit some sort of, you know, deep internal competitive fire. And he came back the next morning and he told Lloyd Carr, I'm going to stay, and I'm going to prove to you that I'm the best quarterback on this team. And really, that innate hunger and need and compulsion to prove himself has never gone away, even as all of these accolades, like you said, have piled up. And so I think that when you see who he is now, that's one of those major components that goes into the entire package.
It's Better to Be Feared is the title of the book. Came out this Tuesday, available wherever books are sold. We've been speaking with the author, Seth Wickersham, who you can follow on Twitter, at Seth Wickersham. Great stuff, Seth. We really appreciate it. Looking forward to reading this and talking to you down the road. Thanks so much for the time.
Thanks, gentlemen.
There you go. That was Seth Wickersham on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline. The new book is out. Robert Kraft calling Bill Belichick names, and all that good stuff is contained within those pages. So
it's an interesting franchise, and just pretty amazing what they've done. You have to say, it's pretty amazing. I'd forgotten that Robert Kraft traded for Bill Belichick.
I did too. I mean, it's been a long time now.
Yeah,
it's been a long time. So easy to forget. So there you go. Interesting stuff there for you NFL fans. Meanwhile, which matchup is the most important for the Seahawks against the Steelers team? We're going to break all of that down next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live through the Alaska Airlines studio on the 710 Sports app.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Our thanks to Seth Wickersham. Good stuff from him. Some people love that, Dave. Others saying, why do you have this guy on here?
I knew that would happen, but, you know.
It's interesting. It's the NFL. Everybody loves the NFL. And the
love
Patriots are an interesting story.
Yeah. You love to hate them.
You do.
And the Seahawks, I mean, look, they created the most painful moment. We go, you know, down to Peoria every year, this show, the afternoon show, before the pandemic. And every time when we drove out to Peoria from the airport, you'd go past whatever the Jiffy Pop popcorn stadium there it looked like. You know, like right when the Jiffy Pop starts
to bubble.
To bubble, then, that's what it looked like. But every time we go past there, I just get a sick feeling.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And every time we've gone in there since, doing the games down there,
it was traumatic.
It was.
It was traumatic, that whole thing. I mean, that doesn't just go away. That's something if you're a hardcore sports fan, Seahawk fan, what have you, you're going to remember that forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't forget that kind of pain. Meanwhile, I sent you this article from Yahoo Sports last night, and they highlighted six key matchups to watch on Sunday Night Football between the Steelers and the Seahawks. And there's some are obvious, some are interesting. First one they've got is Geno Smith versus T.J. Watt. Obviously, they're not going head-to-head. You've got some big bodies in between that will hopefully remain in between those two because Geno's got no shot in that matchup. But that's obviously somebody you have to account for. He's, you know, according to the article, T.J. Watt comes into week six with the league's highest pass rush win rate in a history of knocking quarterbacks out. So that's not good. That's not anything you ever want to deal with. And hopefully the O-line will be able to. I would say, and you tell me if I'm wrong, I would say that pass blocking for the most part, not every single play, but I would say they've been a pretty solid pass blocking group, this O-line. Not great at run blocking.
Yeah, and we'll get to that one, that matchup next. But as far as T.J. Watt goes, I would say so. I would say it's not like Russ has just been running for his life necessarily, but, I mean, this guy averages about 13 sacks a year. So, you know, he had 15 last year. I think he was Defensive Player of the Year in 2019. He had 8 forced fumbles. By the way, one of those was on Chris Carson, and he just, remember, he punched. And it was another, kind of like Darius Leonard did in Indianapolis to Chris Carson. It was just like a perfect little window in wherever, in between his arm and his shoulder pad, and he just punched right in there and just popped the ball out. So Seahawks end up winning that game, but yeah, T.J. Watt, you can see what a great...
He's a problem.
Yeah, he's an extra meanie guy.
Yeah. Well, what about this guy? The next matchup they've got is Seahawks interior line versus Cameron Hayward.
Cameron Hayward is a monster. I was watching the Buffalo Bill game, and he took their center and just marched him back into Josh Allen. I mean, he's so good and so underrated. When we talked to Brooke, Brooke Pryor, who covers the team. I asked her, you know, who's an unsung hero, a guy that you think is really good, not talked about. She immediately, Cam Hayward.
Well, some of the numbers in the story says Hayward has only 1 sack and 2 hits to his name so far this season, but those numbers are a poor indicator of his impact on the game. He's already got 11 pressures, hasn't missed a tackle yet this year. He's also the highest graded interior lineman in the league by
I thought you were going to say by, I don't know.
By Pro Football Focus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like in his 11th year.
Yep.
So, I mean, that guy is impressive. And just like the article said there, I mean, he's a guy that you don't see the stats necessarily, but he's a huge problem. And I got to say, Damian Lewis has had some rough games in San Francisco, I thought. And then, you know, you just haven't really seen the movement off the line in the run blocking game.
Yeah, it's interesting that they've struggled there, but the pass blocking is which they don't seem to like as much. You talk to O-linemen, they love run blocking. They love running people over, and that's their, you know, they really enjoy that part of blocking as opposed to pass blocking, and the roles are reversed. They're decidedly better at pass blocking. So we'll see if they can get that done in terms of run blocking in this game because they're going to need it.
Well, that's a guy to keep your eye on. I mean, number 97.
Yeah,
it's a rough matchup.
How about this one, Tyler Lockett versus Minkah Fitzpatrick? So they're talking about, you know, him, Lockett running the deep crossers. Odds are at some point he's going to come across free safety Minkah Fitzpatrick. Normally one of the league's top deep third defenders, they call him here.
Deep third. What in the world does that mean?
I was hoping you would explain.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sometimes if you're talking about middle third. You know, because if you have cover three, because every coverage I've ever seen broken down, it's underneath droppers and deep droppers, the end. And there's not a third
the
depth.
End.
So, yeah, I mean, if he's talking about middle third, which is typically where safeties do go, I think that's what he's talking about there. But I'm going to go with Tyler Lockett on this.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. The guy is so underrated and just always gets open. He has the most subtle, unusual moves, I would say. He doesn't do the big it's very, like, you have to go back and go, how did he get so wide open? And
ask it every game.
His speed is surprising, and I think it's surprising to opponents, but just the subtlety of his little movements that gets people to either turn their hips and go the wrong way or get their feet tied up or whatever.
Yeah, he doesn't have the over-exaggerated moves. He's not, arms flailing and head jerking all around. He's just pretty quick and concise, and boom, he's all of a sudden, he's got 3 yards of separation there, and he's wide open.
Well, I think that's why he says, I can't really describe how I get open.
Yeah, he's just like, is.
Yeah, I just do it.
It's just amazing. You watch him catch the ball, and there's a guy that's trailing by 3 to 5 yards.
Yep.
All right, this one could be worrisome. Seahawks run defense versus Najee Harris. Now, there's only one team in the league currently worse against the run than the Seahawks, and that's the Chargers. Seahawks are 31st in rushing yards allowed per game at 145.2. The Chargers are allowing 157.6.
Yeah, I was surprised by that with Brandon Staley coach team. But, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to go with Harris until they show differently. I mean, I think they have the guys to do it. You know, it's pretty good. Run players, Rasheem Green, he does a really good job shedding blocks. And sometimes when guys shed a block, they'll do anything to shed the block, and they sometimes will shed it play side, which means now you just put the guy between you and the running back. He does a good job of, you know, always going the right way with it. I like his movement and everything in there, but, like, I mean, I haven't seen certain linebackers attack the line of scrimmage just yet. So, I mean, you know, and there was a great play in, you know, you look in the San Francisco game with Juszczyk, or Juszczyk, as some people
call him at 4 o'clock.
At fullback, and Jordan Brooks comes up and just splatters him in the backfield. But then he got no help after that. So, yeah, it's that to me is that one's going to go to Harris until they can prove differently.
How about this? This is an interesting one. Jamal Adams versus Pete Carroll.
What does that mean?
Well, they're saying that, you know, they do like a large paragraph after each of these. Yeah. I won't read the whole thing. They're saying, yeah, Adams has had his issues this year, but Seattle's coaching staff shares equal on Adams' struggles. Ken Norton Jr. has been using Adams as a blitzer only half as often as last season when he had 9.5 sacks in just 12 games. Ultimately, this failure is on Pete Carroll, though. He gave up 2 first-rounders for Adams and signed him to a massive extension. Not using him correctly after all that is high-level coaching sin.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. But, I mean, look, it's not him versus Pete. It's just they're just trying to figure it out. But, you know, like, he gets beat by the corner route the other day. Was it Higbee that beat him,
yeah,
the Rams? You know, I mean, he's a linebacker. So is that a crime to get beat by a linebacker? Yeah, not, I mean, by a tight end, if you're a linebacker, not really. But if you're that highly paid, you should cover that guy. You should be able to do that. And then I see him, they're playing him deep too much. He needs to be up on the line of scrimmage. But look, Jamal Adams can help himself by, you know, taking on blocks a little bit more stout. And, you know, I think he looks frustrated out there.
Yeah. Last one quickly, Ken Norton versus Big Ben.
Yeah.
So they're just talking about somehow the Seahawks defense manages to be both too predictable and too complicated for the guys trying to make it function correctly, I think. And they said at its core, this unit is too conservative, which will play right into the hands of Roethlisberger. You know, and then they go on to talk about other things. But
they basically said that everybody can figure out what the Seahawks defense is doing
except
the Seahawks defense themselves.
The guys that are running it. That's beautiful.
Gotcha.
All right, there you go. Some key matchups. That's an article off Yahoo Sports. Coming up, might not be a surprise when you hear who made our Y-Man of the Week. That is straight ahead with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Wyman and Bob, brought to you by Angel of the Winds Casino Resort on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Dave Wyman and Bob Stelton.
Hey, the text line is there for you, 206-421-3776. That's 421-ESPN. We will do mean texts in the final hour of the show, as we do every Friday, so get creative. I read you a couple that I couldn't even figure out if they were supposed to be mean texts or just
let's step it up, poorly worded.
I didn't really know how to take them.
Come on.
Something.
Step up your mean texts. I'm challenging you.
Yeah, there was one. I'd have to go back and find it, so I'll just paraphrase. I was making fun of the Nashville Predators uniform, saying they look like jars of mustard skating around out there. And they said something like, yeah, they look like mustard, but Bob spills mustard on his shirt.
Boo.
I'm like, wait, is that a shot? I don't know what. Wait. Okay. So, be better than that. Be better than that. Just get creative with it. It's all good. So 421-3776, 421-ESPN. We'll do that in the final hour. It is time for our Y-Man segment, which we do every single week. And there's always – now, how do you say this guy's last name? Tapera?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think we played this earlier in the week. But I just love that the Astros are on the other end of accusations of cheating. I just love that. That's going to follow him around forever, as it should, at least until this crop of players has finally gone on to other teams or retired. But White Sox reliever Ryan Tepera implies that the Astros are still cheating, and then unfortunately for the White Sox, they lose the next game 10-1 on their home field. But this came prior to that.
Obviously, it's a different game here at our field. You know, you play at Minute Maid, and you know they're doing something over there that's a little different. You know, it shows you how many swings and misses they had tonight compared to Minute Maid. So that's why you have home field advantage. And you know, tomorrow, and you know, we got another home field advantage. So we're ready to go.
Hey, Ryan, I was wondering if you could expand upon what you were saying earlier. They struck out 16 times in the previous two games, but then 16 times tonight. Do you think something else is going on still, or is that just like a hunch given the past?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is what it is. They've obviously had a reputation of, you know, doing some sketchy stuff over there. And we can say that it's a little bit of a difference, you know. I think you saw the swings and misses tonight compared to, you know, the first two games of Minute Maid. But that's not really the story, you know. We come here to play. You know, we're going to compete. We're not even going to worry about what they're going to do. All we have to do is execute pitches, and they can't hit them anyways.
Oh, I think the media people will decide what is and is not a story. He's like, that's not really the story. Yeah, it is.
The problem is they lost 10-1. That's why I just had to do the why, man.
On their home field the next night.
And it was at home, right?
Yeah. So he was accurate at the time when he said, hey, the swings and misses at Minute Maid, substantially different than what just took place on this home field. Huh, those guys have been known to do sketchy things. Problem is, the very next game, they went out on their home field and got their butts handed to him 10-1. So that doesn't help your case. But I do like that.
So you can blame him for the Astros being
just
in
like
the
ALCS. That the Astros will still be questioned, as they should.
Did you fire him up? I mean, does that.
Right.
Probably. In baseball, I mean, we've talked about, like, oh, if you get angry or you're fired up, is that really going to help you in baseball?
I don't think so.
You're going to squeeze the bat a little tighter?
No, this is the playoffs, man. This is the focus is there, the intensity.
Yeah, you don't need an extra edge.
No, if this is game, you know, 70 in the middle of a season, yeah, maybe. Maybe it gives you a little energy if you would otherwise be dragging a little bit. It's midseason. Okay, there. But no, not in the playoffs.
Yeah.
Not in the playoffs. So
really quick, 425, I said step up. He said, step it up. You step it up, idiot. See, now that's better. Okay? That's better. All right. Back to Wyman.
He told you, or she told you, whoever sent that in, they let you know what time it was.
Oh, that's better. It's an improvement.
Idiot. I like the inflection you put on it. You step it up, idiot. Like the anger you put on that. All right. Entry number two comes courtesy of Urban Meyer, everybody, especially John Clayton's favorite head coach in the NFL. This is what his goals are in terms of what he wants the passing game and running game to achieve.
You know, I like our identity right now. If you say, what's the identity of the Jacksonville Jaguar offense? It's a physical offense that runs the ball and balance. You know, our goal is always 250, 250. I want to say we were 250, 200. You know, that's what we want to be. Our tailbacks are running hard, both of them.
Well, just maybe wait 3 weeks, and you can get that.
Yeah, because the Seahawks defense is there for you.
That's
we're
so
here to
mean.
Help.
I mean, sorry. Well,
have they? I didn't go back and look through their box scores. Have they come up with 500 yards of offense in any particular game this year?
You think he meant 250, 150? I mean, that's
five. We want 500 yards of offense per game.
Yeah, this isn't Ohio State. You're not going to be playing, you know, Kentucky or actually Kentucky.
Kentucky's good. We were
good.
Just talking about that.
Yeah.
Maybe like Western Kentucky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Directional school. That's what you need.
Yeah. That's interesting. We play this clip for Clayton later. He'll love it. 250, 250. Yeah. I think he meant 250, 150, but yeah.
Yeah. 500. He's aiming high. That's what he's doing. We'll play it for Clayton. He's coming up next. If you guys have questions for John, text those questions in right now, 421-3776, 421-ESPN. That is coming your way next with Wyman and Bob on 710 ESPN Seattle.